Whereas in technology, sometimes you do stuff and find solutions without necessarily having the same alignment of interests.
Hello, welcome to episode 59 of the MedTech Podcast. You join me, your host, Karandeep Singh Badwell, and on this episode we have Eric, CEO of Matrix Requirements, a leading platform in design and quality control for software medical devices. Eric started his career in finance and tech, having co-founded Radiance, a financial data exchange, and StreamData.io for real-time API. However, during the pandemic of 2020, after organizing a hackathon for his company at the time, he realized a lot of his skills and knowledge he had built in these industries could be beneficial in digital health, hence his transition into healthcare in 2022. In this episode, we delve into the intriguing parallels amongst finance, tech, and healthcare, discover the contrasting approaches of agile and waterfall methods in software developments for medical devices, learn expert strategies for fostering seamless collaboration between departments, navigating the common challenges often faced by developers and quality teams, gain insights into the significance of advisory board positions, exploring reasons to embrace or reconsider them, and share our first-hand encounters and effective tips for maximizing the value of industry conferences. Welcome to the show, Rick. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Still sitting here.
So having worked in API businesses in tech and finance in the past, why did you and how did you transition into the healthcare sector?
So the why is because I was looking for a job with more purpose. So, you know, working for finance or government is interesting, but the purpose is not that obvious, whereas helping people suffer less definitely is a strong purpose. And then I got into it by getting more and more interest into it. During COVID, I organized a hackathon for my company to assess what we could do with APIs to help with the situation. And then I started to discover that there were lots of skills and knowledge I had around IoT and connectivity that could be reused in digital health. So that's the how. Now the how is I had a mutual friend who was looking for who knew somebody who was looking for the CEO of Matrix, as Matrix wanted to get from a purely technically funded company to a scale up.
And how did you find that difference in health and tech? Did you find that the difference in terms of company culture, the way that it worked, or did you find there was a lot of similarities?
Lots of similarities. I think the main difference is the purpose and the focus on patient. Anything that people think about, any decision they make in any discussion, the main priority is always patient experience. So that's a big difference. Whereas in technology, sometimes you do stuff and find solutions without necessarily having the same alignment of interests. But here the interest is aligned. And I really appreciate that when we go to conferences, whoever you speak with, you learn something and you know that the spirit and mindset is the same.
So, of course, working cultures can be different depending on what type of job roles you work with. Somebody like myself who works in quality and reg and working with a tech person can often sometimes have some friction. So effectively, the conclusion that we can both come down to is getting people to change is hard. So in your experience, how exactly do you go by minimizing friction between quality and regulatory people in something like in a world full of developers?
So it's a really interesting situation we're in, because on the one side, you have developers that are used to working in agile, where you start with core requirements and then code and then test a little bit and then get to the next sprint. Whereas in the quality world, we expect for requirements to have been thought through initially and then be traceable down to validation, and then the specifications and software requirements to be traceable down to verification. So that's definitely the biggest challenge I see in class two, class three software companies. Now, how do you go about minimizing it? Our approach is to actually cut complexity in pieces so that it's easier to find a reconciliation of RQA and developer point of view when you're dealing with atomic and units of complexity. So for example, when it comes to design, you will cut the complexity of the design, for example, for an MRI into small pieces and could be hundreds of thousands. And you will make sure that there is traceability up to the requirements for the software requirements and down to tests and test validation. But if you ask a developer to document his code, looking at the entire code from the beginning, it's just a nightmare. And the developer today would change job and go to another company where it's simpler. And what we want is to have developer work in medical devices, because this is where we believe that most of the value for patients is going to come in the next decades. And so to keep them, you want to make sure that their environment is as usual as possible. So the, let's say, the environment for coding with tickets like Jira has to be the same. And then the RQA people have to have this a view of their work and connect this work to a little bit of documentation that you would ask developers to make at the end of each of their story, rather than for the entire code base.
So on the topic of being technical, so the current recognized standard, of course, for software development is 62304, which talks about a V model for software development. How exactly does that compare or even contrast to the usual practice of Agile for software development that many people are used to?
So that's a fascinating piece because, you know, myself coming from the software development world, I'm a big advocate of the Agile Manifesto. And if you read the Agile Manifesto, so first is individuals and interactions over processes and tools. And second is working software over comprehensive documentation. So those two tell you that there's going to be some friction with what is expected from 62304 in terms of developing plans for software development, verification plans, usability engineering, risk management. All this is expected from the regulation. Same with reports. You know, you need the verification reports, validation reports, risk management reports, and to make it possible to work together, I think you need to get to the output, which is going to be the proper documentation of 62304, that, you know, make sure that any software as medical device actually obey to the quality management best practice. So to make it, so that's the output. Now the input is the code. Each line of code is a design statement, so that you actually need to have traceability up to the requirement, down to the test, and in parallel with your risk for each of those lines. That's in principle what should happen. My recommendation is that this implementation of 62304 happens and is prepared at coding level, so that every time a developer is done with a story, he will write what is necessary and expected at the end for his story. That's part of an epic, And at the end, all this is documented in a system. So, you know, of course, my recommendation will be to use an EQMS that can actually gather all those requirements. And those requirements can be gathered together in layers. Like you can build the layer on plans, the layer on specifications, the layer on reports, and then the layer on records, so that you can build a document that you're going to need to send to the authorities. So you ask bit by bit documentation by developers while they're working. So it has to be a new discipline for them to acquire, but it's not impossible. And then it is possible to have a system that actually aggregate them, and by just pushing on a button, we'll generate those documentation, and pushing on another button, we'll submit that to the FDA, thanks to eStar.
So would you say it's quite a large learning curve for the V model or Agile, or do you think it's something that can be learned on the job?
It's a learning curve. So first of all, as for any change, the person that is impacted needs to realize that there is a problem, and there is a pain, there is a crisis. So to do so, I like to help people realize it as soon as possible with a cold shower, which is, okay, we will spend together 2 hours. We will read 62, 304 together and 1345. And then you will understand that we cannot be in business unless we are compliant with this. So if you, at the end, your contribution cannot contribute to this, then you cannot be part of this business. So it's pretty, pretty harsh, but that's the reality. And that's the what we've decided collectively when building those rules to make sure that patients wouldn't be affected by software as medical device or software in medicals with in medical device with 82304. So that's the realization that needs to happen as soon as a software developer joins a medical device company. And if they are not okay with that, then they should move on to another company. Once they realize that, then you have a lot of stress, and because the software developer will realize that there's going to be a lot of work and additional complexity on top of software development complexity, which is already huge, and that's why I would help them by practicing bit by bit. Story by story at the beginning, the little documentation they need to write off. And on that basis, they will feel more and more comfortable with it. So it has to start with a training to me. And then it's on the job training to practice this virtuous habit of documenting your code as often as possible so that it doesn't become a nightmare.
So some of the older companies are very hesitant moving from paperwork to digital. At best, they might move into e-paper by using, you know, some of the platforms that are out there. So how exactly do you go about convincing potential clients at Matrix Requirements to make the switch?
So most of customers coming to us have realized it already. So and why have they realized it? It's because even if they are really small, they were founded by entrepreneurs that are serial entrepreneurs, and they've failed in the past by trying to build their requirement management and quality management too late in the process. Typically, they built a product and then they started to think about compliance. So entrepreneurs with experience know that it's better to work on continuous improvement, continuous integration, continuous development, along with design control from the beginning and quality management from the beginning. For those who do not know, what I see is up until 10 people, it is sometimes okay to, and there is not much pain in managing their design and quality management on paper. So when we say on paper, it's typically with a tabler or word processing tools. So this is okay until 10 people. And then in Excel, you have two dimensions. Traceability typically requires up to 4, 5, 20 dimensions. So your Excel explodes. And by itself, they come back to us and say, well, we understand. We tried to do it with Jira. We tried to do it with Excel, with Confluence. It didn't work. So now we need to move fast because we want our compliance and our application to be with accepted by the FDA and our notified body within 6 months, 12 months. And my investors are asking for it. So yeah, we're going to move on to implementing your software. And then I think when they see other startups that are successful with our software and scale-ups and strategics, then they're convinced. So the example of the success that other companies have seen through by using our software is finalizing their decision.
Do you find that clients are often quite realistic with the deadlines? In my experience, I sometimes come across companies like, hey, currently people want to have a CE mark in 6 months. I'm like, okay, great. But where's your QMS? Like, oh, what's a QMS? I'm like, yeah, not going to happen. Have you experienced that yourself?
Totally. I think the world of RAQA is difficult to imagine unless you've experienced it or worked with that world before. It's like another dimension. It's like living in the matrix. And if you start telling people, well, you're going to have to create some documentation and it will take 18 months for you to identify an authority, notified body to read it, and for them to approve it, it's going to take 18 months. It's totally crazy. And I think it's very different from any of the constraints we're used to in the real world. The real B2B world, there is no other situation where regulation would take so long. So for example, in banking, you have to comply with regulation. You're being audited on a yearly basis as well. But the compliance is something you document yourself, and the authorization to create your bank is never going to take that long. And that's why we get lots of new banks today. So here, indeed, you can tell whether the entrepreneur is into medical device for the first time, or if it's a repeat entrepreneur, just based on those expectation of timeframes and resources as well. And sometimes they're like, oh, I'm going to do it on my own with Excel. And some of them are pretty good at it. And they either turn into RAQA consultant themselves. Like I've met some CEOs that were spending 80% of their time on making sure that the documentation was correct. And you're like, well, maybe your core job should be something different than just RAQA issues. Maybe you can get help from a system and a consultant or a consulting firm. First of all, yeah, your timeframes are unrealistic, and it will be less risky and faster. So you're gonna make more. You're gonna make money faster because you're going to go to market faster by getting some help early on in the process if you've never done it before. If you've done it before, yeah, you can try it with a system. That's what some of our customers do, but they're like repeat entrepreneurs.
And I find another thing is it can also be driven by investors. You know, investors may throw millions and millions at marketing and, you know,
promoting their product as much as they can. But when it comes to the important things like regulation, they just think, yeah, we'll throw 50,000 at it and it'll be done in 6 months. That's like, yeah.
So, and that's, so we talked about the, how you recognize a repeat entrepreneur, same thing with investors. If you have an investor that's into medical device for the first time, then you can tell. They're gonna throw these kind of things in the legs of the CEO, whereas those that are used to it would be insisting upon having or making sure that the company has some design control and at least a plan for a QMS before they invest the money in it, and that's a strong reason for starting design control and QMS early on, actually. Because those investors that are specialized in medical devices actually will ask those questions, because this is a great way for them to de-risk their investment. If they have in front of them a team that just can do a product, or a team that can do a product and design control and QMS, they know that their chances of being successful are way higher when those people have thought about it initially. So I'd say if you get an investor that actually blocks you from making the reasonable investment in QMS and design control, then you have to think about your next round because you have a problem.
Definitely so. So on the topic of investors and VCs, we both, of course, attend industry conferences, with the latest one being Al-Asad Barcelona. We both actually met in person. Yeah. What are your tips for making the most out of these conferences? You know, what tricks or tips do you employ to get the best out of them?
So I think main trick is to spend as much time preparing it as the time you will spend in those conferences. So typically, if you're going to spend 20 hours in a lifetime within the conference, you probably need to spend 15 hours before to prepare it and 5 hours after to follow up. And in the preparation, to me, there are two things. First thing is, in terms of objectives, you need to be clear about your objectives: raising fund, networking, meeting some, maybe creating your board. You may have different objectives, but you need to know what these are. On that basis, you want to list what are the companies that should be of interest to you to meet with. And on that basis, there is a great tool for the best conferences, including LSI. There's a great tool for networking where you can actually ask people, transparently telling them the reason why you think you should have a discussion. You can actually allocate a time slot on it. The worst thing would be to go there unprepared, without any meeting planned, and just going to the conferences, just going to the presentations, because then you miss, to me, 90% of the interest of those type of conferences. So that's LSI, where there is a great networking tool, but then there are other conferences where there is no such networking tool. So here, well, you have to ask yourself whether you want to go there. And then if you decide to go there, make sure you leverage as much as possible the networking times for people to come to you to have the discussion you want to have.
Another thing I would add to that, perhaps, is if there's anybody that you know in your network, it may be just worth messaging them beforehand, letting them know you're going to be there. Because I know, Eric, you attended the LSI in London, and we both hadn't realized that we were both there at the conference. But just letting people know that you are there, you then realize that, okay, I should look out for this person or make some time for them.
You're right.
And I think another point I would add to that is, you know, don't be afraid to just strike up conversations with people, because at conferences, both people are there for a reason. You know, you're not just walking down the street. You're there for a purpose. You're there in a similar industry, etc. If someone is just walking past you, don't be afraid to just strike up a conversation with them, because, you know, there's only so many meetings you can have in a formal sense, but there's probably plenty of time where you can just have quick 5-minute catch-ups with people. And I feel as though that's what people miss out on.
Yeah.
So then, Eric, you're a very, very busy man, I know, running a business, going to conferences, etc. What are you getting to outside of work?
Well, first of all, I have three sons, so that's that keeps me pretty busy. Will be different in 10 years, but right now I'm pretty busy raising my sons. And then outside that, I'm a recreative outdoors passion, especially for mountains. So I spent quite some time in the Alps, hiking, skiing, cross-country skiing. And then by the ocean, I like surfing, I like freediving, spearfishing, sailing. So nothing professional. I'm not a champion in any of those disciplines, but I just enjoy practicing them regularly, and yeah, I love outdoors.
So another thing I know you've done over the past few years is be an advisory board member for many different types of companies. How exactly do you get these positions, and why should you or why should you not consider them?
So how I got them, people came to me because they were considering that I could help with the development of their company at some point in its growth. So yeah, that's not something I went after. And what I've refused were positions that were coming with a level of requirement or commitment that would go or that would conflict with my main area of focus, which is metrics today, stream data yesterday, and Radiance before. So yeah, I remember that the focus is my own company, the company I lead. But then it's really great to contribute to, well, helping people. That's a given. But also sometimes you learn from some situations. So there's an element of serendipity in helping other companies by just, attending a meeting, let's say once a quarter, 2 hours with 1 hour of preparation. You get a lot out of it on the personal side, but also on the professional side.
So Eric, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. What one piece of advice would you be leaving the listeners with?
So I think the most important thing for anybody, either startup leaders or students, is to first know what you like, know what you want, follow your passion, then you're going to be very good at it. And once you're very good at it, then you will attract opportunities. So rather than trying to fish for opportunities, fish for skills and knowledge and relationships, because this is what will bring opportunities to you. And if it happens to be in healthcare, then it is, to me, the best environment to actually strive from a spiritual standpoint as well. And if it happens to be in medtech, within healthcare, it is the best way to when you're passionate about technology, it is the best way to reconcile your passion for technology with the purpose and the sense of day-to-day work, because you know you're helping people. So that's my little recommendation.
Thank you very much for your time, Eric.
It makes sense. Thank you. Thank you, Candy.
Thank you for listening to episode 59 of the MedTech Podcast. If you have not already done so, please subscribe. If you wish to learn more about Eric, you can connect with him online or visit his company website, the links of which are provided in the description. If there are any particular topics or guests you'd like for me to have on the show in future, then feel free to reach out.